noise filled the hallway and thrummed through doors as she approached. The cooling system ensured that the machines didn't overheat. A computer serving web pages, rendering 3D images, and executing dozens of other applications generated heat like someone running a 5K in the Mojave Desert. Without someone to throw ice water every 100 feet, they'd go nowhere. Kate knew servers. A computer science degree had landed her a position at Microsoft. She'd pen-tested systems and looked for exploits that needed closing. But the glory days of the company's stock options were past. She'd left after a few years and started her own online security consulting firm. On a lark, she'd also enrolled in an Internet University's private investigation course. She learned about courts and the shortcomings of the legal system, civil and criminal case investigation, and most importantly, how to break into places. Her actual business card, as opposed to the fake one on her lanyard, read, "Catherine J. Manners, P.I. Security Consulting and Private Investigation. Discreet. Professional. Experienced. Full service. Free consults." Most of Kate's caseload came from suspicious spouses. Talk about work that would turn even the most idealistic do-gooder into a cynic. But bills needed paying. When a case came her way, she could usually scan a database remotely from a coffee shop using its free Wi-Fi, correlate the results with whatever she was trying to discover for her client, and call it a day. But she enjoyed actual investigation, too, especially when she could dress for the part, like the gown and high heels she'd worn to attend an ambassadorial ball. Of course, that time she'd been invited. Someone had to make sure the visiting ambassador from Kobe, Seattle's sister city, could get a video connection back to Japan for the Hands Across the Ocean celebration. And they served sushi. But tonight, it was back to coveralls, comfort-fit sneakers, and her plant-watering cart. Her client, Michael Bradley, wanted her to locate evidence of malware infecting the BDR servers. According to Bradley, the BDR servers were rotten with malicious exploits, but because BDR didn't want the bad PR, didn't care, or didn't have the resources to deal with the issue, they'd ignored Bradley's warnings. As a client whose web pages had been hacked over and over because of the hosting company's malfeasance, Bradley was already pissed off. He said he wanted more than just his money back for the 6 months he'd rented server space. He wanted BDR to admit it was culpable, or better yet, to get a judgment against the company. Kate had worked with too many non-technical managers with the same mindset as BDR when it came to news they didn't want to hear, and frankly, didn't really understand. Sometimes people had to be hit over the head with a blunt object before they'd admit the sky actually was falling. Tonight, Kate would find the evidence required to serve as that blunt object. Life was good. She opened the thrumming doors. Servers towered in the dim space beyond, at least 4 or 5 rows of them. The wail of the fans pummeled her, but she decided not to stuff foam plugs in her ears. If the security guy left his desk in the lobby, she wanted a chance to hear him, even over the background whine. Kate parked her plant cart along the wall in the hallway, then entered the server room. The computer that administered all the others, the one she hadn't been able to ping remotely, would be in here somewhere. She began walking the rows. Actually, unless the managers at BDR were total dicks, the administrator's computer would be in a side room with walls and a door to block out fan noise. She found the control computer, set right out in the open, at the end of the 3rd row of servers. Total dicks, then. Good to know. Kate sat. Her reflection, red hair and pale skin, frowned back at her until she called up the command line. She began acquainting herself with the workstation's login procedure. The lights in the room flickered. She looked up, brows gathering. Then the fans cut out, and her hands fell from the keyboard. The lights dimmed further, and the fans stayed off. All the lights that had been dancing on each server bank were gone. It was probably a coincidence, but time to call it a night. If a brownout had disabled BDR's primary power, systems engineers would be crawling all over the place in 10 minutes to make certain the backup power sources came online. All the overhead fluorescents failed completely, leaving her blind in absolute darkness. Kate waited a few seconds, but nope. Whatever had killed the lights had taken the uninterruptible backup batteries with them. And what the hell? The red glow that should have illuminated the exit letters over the door was gone. Either she was facing the wrong way, or she didn't know what. Exit signs that lost power were bad news, however you sliced it. Clattering erupted somewhere behind her. She jerked round. Brilliant light flashed on off from around the farthest banks of servers. Was it a server shorting out? No. The power outage meant that there wasn't enough juice for that kind of mayhem. Maybe she'd missed an engineer on night duty. If so, what were they doing over there? Welding? Didn't seem likely. Kate considered bolting. But really? Any PI worth her gun would investigate. Fuck. Speaking of which, good. A quick pat reassured her that her Beretta 9mm remained in the holster strap beneath her coveralls. It wasn't illegal for her to carry a hidden handgun in Washington, so long as she carried her concealed pistol license, too. She'd got the gun used, but God, she wished the owner hadn't felt compelled to tell her the gun's name was Malcolm. Who names a gun? That guy, apparently. Roel didn't like that she carried it. He said it was more likely to get her shot. Statistics proved it. Maybe. But Raoul had passed on that gem long after she'd gotten used to wearing the thing. C'est la vie. Kate padded closer to the sound and light. Though she was tempted to draw it, she left Malcolm. Damn it, now she was calling it by name. She left the gun in its holster. An odor like burnt rubber curled her lip. She rounded a server and saw the light source. Her mouth dropped open. A twisting pillar was growing up from the floor. No, that wasn't it. The shape wasn't growing so much as it was being built. Like something a 3D printer might produce, one layer at a time. These days she couldn't go a week without seeing at least one breathless tech story about how 3D printers were poised to change the economy, could print entire houses, and might one day be used to construct a moon base. But printers were bulky, boxy, slow devices able to extrude something the size of a toy plushie after a couple of hours. Whatever was growing before her eyes was already 4 feet tall and adding inches every second. And where was the 3D printer itself? Nowhere. As the final layers of the object slapped into place, she saw that something was a someone. A man. With no clothing. The flickering light died before she could see anything else. The burning tire smell was worse than ever, but without the strobing light, the room was pitch black again. "Who are you?" Kate shouted into the black. No answer. Realizing that she was on the verge of hyperventilating, Kate concentrated on drawing deeper, calming breaths. No easy task. She had never liked the dark. She had a flashlight app on her phones, but she didn't really want to confirm whether or not a man had been assembled out of nothing right before her eyes in mere seconds. Had she just suffered a stroke, or was someone playing a trick to dupe the private investigator who didn't realize her cover was blown? A groan emerged from the dark. "Oh, shit," she said, flinching backwards. Whether she was having an aneurysm, was the target of an elaborate anti-industrial espionage sting, or especially if a mute mandroid had beamed down to flash Earth women. It was time to go. Which meant she needed to see. Her phone's LED blazed. A clear view of the way out beckoned. Except she couldn't help herself. She swung the beam back. The man wasn't a hallucination. But he was no longer standing. Instead, he slumped against the servers, head in one hand. When she held the beam on him, a hint of bones and organs showed through translucent skin. Shocked, She played the beam across him again. Yep, she could see his ribs, his lungs, his heart, and an enormous ring on one hand that wasn't the least bit transparent. Holy shit! Kate wondered why she wasn't running away, maybe trailing a scream for effect. Really, was that such a bad idea? But, she thought, what would the fictional heroines she admire most do in this situation? No, they wouldn't run. Dana Scully would do something stupid, of course. She would investigate. The man lifted his head and fixed her with watery brown eyes.
Help,
he said. His voice was strained, but human. She realized the intruder wasn't a mandroid. He was just some poor slob who needed a hand, never mind what she thought she'd seen. A perfectly reasonable explanation, once she heard it, would clear everything up. Relief and concern made her giddy as she went to him. The same relief she felt was mirrored on his face, but, yuck, she could see the bones of his skull.
What the hell happened to you? What's your name?
He was obviously incredibly sick, though with what she couldn't guess.
I'm a messenger, he said, his voice weak. Call me Jason. But something's wrong.
His free hand caught hers.
Please help me.
His skin was damp and soft. His grip was weak as a baby's. Kate didn't pull free. The stranger needed a good Samaritan. She said, Don't worry, Jason. I'm calling 911. The hospital is a couple of blocks from here. An ambulance will be here in 5 minutes. You're going to be fine. Saying it didn't make it so, but it sounded reassuring.
No, I can't go, Jason said, his voice weaker than before. I have to talk to Lisa. Her anchor isn't stable. Look at what happened to me. I'm to give her the Ring of Desire. But now that I'm here, I don't really want to die.
Die? Listen, you're sick, but you'll be all right, she said. Though the more she played her light on him, the less she believed it. You need medical help right away.
Won't do any good. Thanks for trying to help. I didn't expect kindness. It almost makes me wish.
The man's words slurred into a coughing fit. Jason?
I'm sorry for my part in this. I didn't realize I had a choice until I came here. The ring.
A fiercer coughing fit overcame him. What about it? Back to silence and darkness, Kate abandoned the call to 911 mid-dial. In the LED's light, she saw that he'd stopped moving.
Jason, she said.
His hand somehow slipped out of hers. Kate reached to retrieve it, then froze. The man liquefied. All at once, arms, torso, legs, and all the rest of Jason slumped like a wax candle in a frying pan, forming a circle of cloudy pink goo.
I'm losing my fucking mind, she whispered. She was in an episode of the X-Files, after all.
When the widening circle of liquid threatened to lap over the soles of her sneakers, Kate retreated a step. All that remained was the oversized ring she'd first seen Jason wearing. It hadn't melted. Mind numb, she retrieved it with her free hand. Tiny inscribed designs, maybe words in a language she didn't know, spiraled around the band set with a massive transparent green stone so large that it had to be costume jewelry. A small section under the ring was loose. When she wiggled it, the whole piece came away, revealing itself as a sleeve for a slender, metallic square. The silver square was perfectly sized for insertion into nearly any computer she could name. The ring and a USB flash drive nestled in her palm. Chapter 4. Duplication. Jason Cole. Lord of Mageddon had many names. To some, he was War. To others, Legion. To most, he was simply the Betrayer. But among himself, he was Jason. Homunculi peered at Jason from their stations on either side of the exit. Each was a copy, but their bright scarlet coloration denoted their status as inferior clones of the original, of him. Jason said, "Open." A mechanism chattered. The gate slabs parted. Jason and his lieutenant swept into a passage lit by violet flames and up two further flights of charcoal-toned stairs. The sound of slapping feet on the stairs behind made Jason look round. A clone scampered up from the warrens they'd just quit, gabbling excitedly. Its green skin marked its low grade. Three reds charged after it, cursing, their carapace-like armor clacking. Jason frowned at hearing his own obscenities in the mouths of reds. It was almost as upsetting as the clone's failure to shut the gate after he'd left. Because of their lapse, a runner was loose. One red pursuer brandished a club. The club wielder and two sibling clones cornered their quarry on the landing below where Jason and his lieutenant watched. The green homunculus realized it was trapped, but made a break for freedom of the next flight anyway, hands clutching for its progenitor, Jason. Jason stepped forward to meet the runner with an elbow. The impact literally smashed its face in, though Jason felt only a satisfying jolt. The homunculus gave a bubbly exhalation rather than a scream as it collapsed. Its left leg twitched a few times before it went still. As usual, he felt no remorse. In a way, his homunculi were even less real than everything else in Ardeen. And he despised them even more than everyone and everything else because of it. The red handlers, who chased their charge up from the warrens, only to lose it at the last moment, stared at the Lord of Mageddon with wide, panicky eyes. "Get out of here," Jason yelled, "before I recycle all of you." Seeing his own reflected, albeit red-hued features contorted in fear, pissed Jason off. Lucky for them, he was anticipating good news. Fresh rumors of progress in his contact foundry promised an end to Jason's imprisonment. The clone snatched the limp body and hustled away. Jason said, "Why is it the greens who always manage to get loose?" "Because," replied his translucent-skinned lieutenant named Gamma, in a voice most people would find indistinguishable from Jason's own, "they're determined." "How can they be determined?" Jason said. "They're hardly smarter than rabbits." "Exactly," Gamma said. "Greens don't understand repercussions or grasp consequences. They act in the moment." He knew that, of course. A clone without a trace of soul code to govern it almost invariably came out of the vats with the wits of a beetle. But the power resident in Jason's true name was already stretched as thin as he dared expand it. Green and yellow-grade clones got nothing from Jason except his likeness and a few reflexes. The higher grades rated a share of the betrayer's unique identifier number, his soul code, and they only got a bit. The only clones who received a nearly complete copy were his lieutenants, which was why Jason manufactured lieutenants who were completely translucent, so no one would ever mistake an ersatz homunculus for the real deal. Ever again, he thought. That time himself revolted had taught Jason a lot, starting with how to begin from scratch with an entirely new batch of homunculi. The carapace armor he still allowed his lieutenants was see-through. He didn't want them hiding anything from him. Back when his ring still functioned, Jason had been able to substantiate hundreds of instances with a thought, maybe even thousands if given enough time, before his ring was broken and the Maker was betrayed and slain. Jason touched the cracked metal circle he wore around his neck on a chain and brought it to his lips, then gazed through it. Even damaged, the Ring of War contained a trace of its former power. Despite all his searching for alternate ways to tease out multiple simultaneously active instances of himself, the scrap of metal was the only thing that still allowed Jason to share his soul code at all. Even if just partial copies of it to a few hundred homunculi in Mageddon, enough to give a few of them a semblance of competence. "You've been doing that a lot lately," said his lieutenant. "Doing what?" "Looking through your ring like it was a window to a better time. Do you miss your friends after all this time?"
"Piss off," said Jason. Of course, Gamma wasn't wrong. Gamma was partly him, after all.
And despite everything, sometimes Jason missed Alice, Mel, Sanders, Bradley, even Carter. He and Carter used to get root beer floats once a month. They both joked about how childish their tradition was, but Jason was sure Carter looked forward to it as much as him. That was long before everything went bad. Ancient history. For a long time, he'd felt horrible that his move against Carter ruined his friendship with the others. Stripped of their incarnations like he had been, Mel had slunk off and ended up taking over Hazurium, vowing to never speak to him again. Everyone else had simply disappeared. He hadn't had the heart to go looking for them then. And by now they were probably all dead. He hadn't kept tabs. He dropped the ring, which flopped back onto his chest, its chain clinking. The trinket had once granted him the power of a god in Ardeen, back when the Maker had counted him as a friend. As Ardeen's aspect of war, Jason could become a literal army with a thought. His thoughts raced simultaneously in every instance, and his capacities were magnified to superhuman levels. It's been mind-blowingly awesome, probably. Actually, it was difficult to recall with great clarity what being war had been truly like, retaining even a tenth of the thoughts and plans and exultations that had flashed through a thousand minds at once was impossible in his current limited state. Plus, separating what actually happened and what had been part of the extrapolated age of myth was no easy task. Carter's injection of faux history had made everything possible in the strange, given structure to chaos, and had been the difference between living and dying when they'd all accidentally come here. But Jason still hated Carter Morrison, or as he'd later come to be called, Carter Strange, the Maker. It should have been him, not Carter, who'd become the god of Ardeen. But as usual, Carter had to steal all the glory for himself. Then strand him here in a place where magic worked, wonders walked, and they had become like gods. Except it was all a lie. It had seemed real enough to fool everyone, even Jason for a time. But he'd come to realize it was a prison. He couldn't return to Earth, and killing the Maker had only further limited his options instead of providing an escape route back to reality. Though if Jason had it all to do over, even though it meant breaking his ring again, he'd still kill Carter. "We have an appointment," Gamma said, breaking Jason's reverie. "Stop obsessing, we're close, it's all still possible." "Didn't I tell you to piss off?" But Jason fell into step beside his clear-skinned clone. There wasn't enough difference between himself and the seven lieutenants, who shared most of his soul code for him, to become too angry with any of them. Usually, in this case, the homunculus was right. If his latest scheme panned out, he'd surpass even what he'd been before. He'd claim for himself not only war's full power, but also the Maker's mantle and abilities, as it should have always been. Then he'd remake Ardeen out of spite, as a new recursion. It would be a whole new world, one where Jason called the shots. But returning to Earth was goal one. They passed around the monstrous mouth of the pit reactor. Purple light glimmered in its torpid depths. It was supposed to have been a source of unlimited power, but for all its promise, the pit reactor remained a disappointment. good for providing extra light, but not much else. Siphoning energy directly from the insane, infinite flux of the strange was tricky. Jason and his homunculi consistently erred on the side of caution rather than see Mageddon blasted out of existence by a flare of loose chaos. Maybe that was why the pit consistently failed to deliver. His other projects were more or less in the same lackluster state, except for a few standouts. One foundry was devoted to scraping soul codes from slaves purchased in Ardeen, then repurposing the unique identifiers for Jason's lower-grade homunculi. Despite a few snags, his Lieutenant Theta, who oversaw the repurposing project, claims that the problems were nearly licked. Theta had been saying that for years. Jason was beginning to have his doubts about Theta. In the next chamber, Reds labored to understand and utilize a collection of items imbued with magical powers gathered from around Ardeen. Jason had claimed a couple for himself after his ring failed, including his belt, that granted him greatly increased strength for limited periods. The chamber also stored relics washed up from the depths of the strange on Ardeen's border. Those were mostly confined to a vault and rarely experimented with, because those who did the experimenting had a tendency to disintegrate. And of course there was the electronics foundry. He'd added it only 40 years ago. For decades, Jason had labored under the misapprehension that because magic worked in Ardeen, regular science wouldn't. Thankfully, he'd been proved wrong. Sure, he hadn't been able to do anything he couldn't have accomplished back on Earth, and in most cases, given his lack of tools and an industrial base, far less. But he'd had a few successes in the last couple of years. Jason had the unique advantage of being able to cheat using magic. He and his clones started with transistors and worked their way up from there. It had been grueling, but he'd achieved his goal. An operating system capable of storing and accessing vast amounts of data. Moreover, one with data pointing the way back to Ardeen and the Strange, based on Peter Sanders' seminal research so long ago. Jason walked past the xenobiology foundry, where his ace in the hole waited with the infinite patience of ice. The Cray had helped him before. That aid had come at a price. The Cray were not sentient in the same way humans were. He'd only make a new deal with them as a last resort. The creatures were not of Ardeen, they were of the Strange, and all too real for Jason's liking. They scared him. Thankfully, the era of fear and quisling bargains was over. Earth had called. Someone was replicating Sanders' work, trying to wring more computer cycles out of quantum inflation. They didn't have what they needed to make a solid or even lasting connection to the Strange. But that's where Jason's carefully devised flash drive came in. If everything worked as he'd devised, his dreams were on the cusp of... His elation faltered. The 2 dozen massive crystal screens in the contact foundry, each manned by red homunculi on high catwalks, were dark, or showed only static. Etta, his lieutenant in charge of contact, was fiddling at the open face of a massive piece of engineering. Etta called it the Baryonic Interferometer Transport Relay, or BITER, for short. "What's wrong?" he asked. Etta looked up. "What's it look like?" Jason balled his hands into fists. He took a deep breath. "Don't test me, clone." Etta's eyes widened. Simultaneously, he heard a surprised breath from the other homunculi in the chamber. Etta's expression flattened in a way familiar to Jason. His translucent lieutenants were most like himself. They hated to be called out as clones. It was their unspoken rule. At that moment, Jason didn't give a rat's ass, but he didn't have time for theatrics. To smooth things over, he lied. "Listen, sorry about that, mea culpa, all right? Just tell me what happened to our connection with Banks and Paldridge." Etta fumed. Jason wondered if the homunculus was stupid enough to jeopardize everything themselves had been working for over a slight. If so, Jason was ready to make an example. "The entanglement remains," said Etta after swallowing his anger. "We haven't lost the connection. Time scales remain conjoined."
"Thank the Maker for that. If we'd lost it..." Well, he didn't have to imagine that dismal hell.
"And the status of the courier? And of the trove?"
The trove was a repurposed ring, the ring of desire holding the flash drive.
Apparently, war and desire had had a thing back in the age of myth, before Jason's time. His memory, or rather war's memory, suggested that desire had enjoyed an unhealthy influence over war. Or, in other words, desire had wrapped war around her little finger more than once. Which was why Jason was glad to consign the Ring of Desire to Earth. With desire out of the picture in Ardeen, he removed one more potential complication to his plans. Besides, rings seemed to be about the only physical objects, besides his own copies, able to make the transition.
Etta shook his head.
"We detected the printing event. As we suspected, uplink fidelity was barely sufficient to make the transfer. Even hardened to withstand it, the homunculi barely integrated."
"Did the courier make the handoff? Do Banks and Paldridge have what they need?"
"The courier lost cohesion after printing. He either spontaneously dissolved or something took exception to his appearance, but..." Etta held up his hand, seeing Jason's imminent interruption. "I've confirmed that the trove made the transfer intact."
"Excellent," he replied, relief like a weight falling from his shoulders.
Even if Liza Banks and Paldridge did nothing with the courier's gift, Jason had hidden auto-run code on the flash drive. It would automatically install itself if inserted into any USB port, and then begin uploading onto hundreds of torrent sites, as well as other sites computer geeks favored. Sooner or later, someone would find Jason's instructions on building a better computer and implement them. It shouldn't take long, either way. Banks was already moving in the right direction, half-assed as it was. Virtual particle printing in the baryonic world required specified coordinates in space-time. And even more importantly, a connection made first from outside the network. All the computational power of the primeval dark energy network couldn't change that. When what he'd coded on the trove was implemented into hardware running the proper software on Earth, a pure locational signal would stir the strange. And like the planet of Oars who'd been attracted to their first intrusion, Jason would be waiting. He'd swarm up that link before the Cray or anything else out of the dark energy network could do so. He would establish a new node of control, fling wide the doors to the Maker's Hall, and become the god of Ardeen he should have been all along. Until he remade it into something else, or he might just leave while the getting was good and let Ardeen rot. It was tempting.
"You're smiling," Gamma said, though the clone's face also wore a wolfish grin, as did Etta's.
Jason laughed. They all laughed. It was all still possible, indeed.
"Soon, my brothers," he said, feeling magnanimous, "we'll be one again. A gestalt mind with limitless power. We'll be war."
Most of themselves cheered. He wondered if some of them were worried he'd abandon them all and go to Earth. Probably. They were partly him, so they knew his secret urges, too. Turning his back on the mastery the Maker's Hall would grant him, even if he did return to Earth, was going to be difficult. He knew himself. What if he could retain the power of war, or even the Maker, on Earth? How crazy would that be? Here it hardly mattered what he did among the kingdoms of make-believe, but back home actual people would see. Real people. Frankly, he was surprised he hadn't fully committed to taking power in the universe of normal matter before. Sure, he considered it, wondering if he had the balls to try. Now that things seemed to be going his way, he was decided. He'd go for it. Why should he leave all the advantages gained in Ardeen behind? And after we make Ardeen ours, we'll have Earth for dessert, Jason shouted. Louder cheering. He yelled too, giving the V for victory sign.
Don't you feel even a little bit guilty, said Delta, the one clone who hadn't cheered. Earth was our home.
Jason didn't want to ruin the moment, so he didn't kill Delta. Instead, he said, look at it this way. It's going to happen sooner or later, even if we do nothing. Eventually, someone else on Earth will rediscover the right energy domains, either with a quantum computing advance or when the Large Hadron Collider achieves high enough energy. Every sentient species in the universe that doesn't kill itself some other way eventually trips the trap. It's destiny. At least we are human. The children of Earth should be the ones to reap the rewards of the strange, not some emergent AI intelligence or alien parasite, unlike what normally happens in this rat-eat-rat cosmos.
Sounds as if you've been practicing that in a mirror.
Jason shook his head. No. Well, yeah. But that doesn't make it untrue. I'm being proactive. For all its size, Ardeen can't stand up to what lies beyond the borderlands. We've been lucky so far, but luck doesn't last forever. Cray are bottom feeders compared to what else swims farther out, and the Cray almost killed us all without half trying, even when the Maker and all the incarnations were still kicking.
Jason realized he was yelling. Damn it.
The homunculus had put him on the defensive. He balled his hands into fists.
You doth protest too much, methinks, said Delta.
That's it, said Jason. He clapped the clone on the forehead. Delta didn't realize what he was doing before it was too late. Jason knew, because he could feel Delta's mind as it came apart, when the portion of their shared soul code merged. The body dropped to the floor, moldering to dust in seconds. Jason met the stares of the others. No further comments were offered. The advantage of heading an organization made up of your own clones was knowing them so well. An occasional demonstration of where the balance of power lay was required for someone of his particular temperament. But shit, now he was down a lieutenant. At least Delta had been assigned to the pit reactor, not one of the more critical foundries. All he had to do was wait and let the flash drive that had been printed on Earth do its work. No need to accelerate the process by involving the Cray, thankfully. Each additional piece of lore gained from his alien friends robbed Jason of more independence. And given that he was an incarnation, one of the manifestations of the seven rules that kept Ardeen safe, making deals with the Cray probably weakened Ardeen's defenses, too. But without the Cray's initial aid, he would never have managed to kill the Maker in the first place, and more recently, learn how to build Biter. He nodded to himself. The Cray expected Jason to continue asking for help. They expected they would be the ones calling the shots eventually, not Jason. Not that the Cray thought and planned in the way people did, but whatever. A chime rang through the chamber. Jason didn't immediately realize where the sound originated or its significance. Surprise blossomed on Gamma's face. The clone pointed at Jason. Jason looked down at his chest. His cracked ring glowed red like an ember kicked out of a fire. The noise of the tolling chime was dying away, but had obviously originated from the loop of metal.
Oh, no. He whispered.
Lines from an old Earth movie slithered into his brain. When our joy is at its zenith, when all is most right with the world, the most unthinkable disasters descend upon us. Except it wasn't unthinkable. Unlikely, but there it was. That fucker Carter had hidden a sleeper somewhere in the cloud, a sleeper who was waking up. In Ardeen,
or lost in the infinity past the borderlands, or maybe even on Earth itself, Carter Morrison, also known as Carter Strange, was back. Chapter 5, Resurrection, Carter Morrison. A line burned across darkness. My eyes stung like I'd touched them with hot sauce still on my fingers. Blinking eased that sensation, but the bright splinter in the blackness remained. Craning my head around, I tried to make out where I was lying. The glow was just enough to illuminate the walls of a smallish room. The floor beneath me was stone hard and cold. Cement? Maybe. Felt like it. I was apparently having a nap in a self-storage unit. The light leaked in from under the single closed garage door. Why the hell was I sleeping in a storage unit? Then holy shit, where were my clothes? Had I been drinking? A couple of plastic bins were stacked along the wall. A tarp-draped car filled out most of the space. I could just make out a dark bulb and a fixture overhead. The smell of oil and dust filled my nose and throat, and I sneezed. Pushing myself into a sitting position, something furry crushed under my left palm before I could snatch my hand back. Ugh, dead mouse? I didn't want to know. Waking up and not remembering where you are can be sort of pleasant, as long as it doesn't last for more than a few seconds. Which is why I felt the opposite of worry-free. The last thing I remembered was... nothing came. Oh, crap. My voice was hoarse with disuse. Movies where people were slipped memory-wiping roofies? Those I suddenly recalled. Had that happened? I didn't remember being at a party. But then again, I suppose I wouldn't. My legs were like two dead stumps, I discovered, when I tried to stand. Luckily, the dusty tarp hiding the car was close enough to collapse on. I waited a few seconds, then stamped experimentally, leaning on the car for support. Numbness gave way to a fire of pins and needles. I groaned, but continued my stamping, shuffling dance until I trusted myself enough to reach for the dangling cord. The bulb washed the room in bleach-white light. Squinting, I checked out the two bins. The top one was labeled with black marker on masking tape with my name, Carter Morrison. It contained a full change of clothing, including underwear, shoes, a pullover, and a navy blue peacoat. I didn't recognize any of the articles, but they were all my size. How considerate of my kidnappers. Though I didn't want to think about why they'd stripped me in the first place. The other bin held a couple of protein bars, a bottle of water, key, and a fob, and a cell phone. The cell was dead, of course, but my also-thoughtful abductors had dropped me in a storage unit with an outlet charger already plugged in. I did what was apparently expected of me and connected the phone. While the mobile charged, I checked myself for stitches or incisions in case I'd fallen afoul of organ thieves. Those stories were probably just urban legends, but when you find yourself undressed and clueless in a storage unit, you have to examine your assumptions. No obvious signs of medical interventions, which relieved that particular anxiety, so I dressed. Eventually, the pieces would fall into place one way or the other, I hoped. Until then, I needed to keep moving forward. It was that, or have a freakout. Maybe I'd save panic for later. The sweater was fleece, and I zipped the collar up tight. It was cold in the tiny garage. I couldn't have been lying on the cement for long, or I'd have frozen to death. The shoes were brand new Doc Martens, my favorite, which meant my kidnappers knew my tastes. I filed that away for later consideration as I slipped them over my feet. They'd take a little breaking in, but... A poster was tacked to the closed garage door. Beneath an image of someone riding a winged fantasy beast across the stars was a message. Ardeen, Land of the Curse. Releases May 20th. Pre-order your copy today. Relief flowed through me like a cooling summer breeze. I remembered that poster. Oh, yes. I nodded at the advertisement like the old friend it was. Jason, Mel, Bradley, and I spent 3 difficult years creating the code base for Ardine. Ordering the promotional posters had been putting the cart way before the horse. On the other hand, we'd purposely left the year off the release date because we weren't complete idiots. Someone thought they were being funny by slapping the poster in here with me. I wonder who. If the game had launched, things would have finally come together for me. For starters, I'd have been sipping lattes in a palatial bedroom looking out on a fabulous view of the Cascades instead of waking up witless in a glorified garage. But Ardine had run into corporate inertia. Funding shortfalls saw to the game's death before its debut, despite everything I could do. At least, that was how I told the story to everyone else. To myself, I couldn't lie. Ultimately, it came down to my own knack for pulling failure out of the jaws of success. Ardine was one more debacle in a long string of fuck-ups. My ego had brought Ardine to the precipice, where I refused to give up the least iota of control of my baby to anyone else. And that was that. Without jobs and a failed MMORPG on our resumes, it was easy for Peter Sanders to reel us back into the academic careers we'd abandoned for our game. In fact, it was Sanders' paper on recursion. It all came back to me then. We'd been mapped onto an alien network. Mapped so completely that our minds transferred, maybe even our souls. Except I'd clawed my way back out of the system. I'd severed the connections our left-behind bodies retained. The memory made my stomach taut, and I gagged. After murdering my friends, I dropped a copy of Ardine, Land of the Curse, into the primordial network by imposing the rigid rules the game represented into the unformatted chaos. I'd hoped to hedge out the planetivores that had already gotten Earth sent. Maybe even sever the connection completely. Then, like a harebrained idiot, I'd tried to go back into that strange stratum and find my friends to see if I could save them. After that, I recalled nothing. Had I found my friends or even reconnected? My mind was as empty of memory as a cloudless sky. It was as if no time had passed at all, until I woke up shivering on cement, wondering about the state of my kidneys. Motherfucker, I muttered. I approached the Ardine release poster. One edge was peeled back. I lifted it and saw a message I'd never seen before scrawled on the back. Find Bradley. He'll tell you what you need to know. The message was signed by me. The signature looked careful, like the way I sometimes did when I wanted my name to be at least halfway legible. But I knew, serially and completely, that I had not written that message, signed it, or for that matter, prepared this storage unit bunker for myself as the presence of the poster implied. How was I so sure? I don't know. But I was certain about that, if nothing else. But if not me, then who and why? The freak out I'd promised myself earlier clawed up the base of my spine. Fear of the unknown had always been my downfall. I was a planner, goal-oriented, my high school counselor had said. My postdoctoral advisor had agreed, even when I left the PhD program code a game. But here was the unknown, with a capital U, staring me down in my own handwriting. How can I plan for something I couldn't even comprehend? My hands, suddenly trembling and nerveless, let go of the poster. The edge settled back until it was flush with the wall once more. Chapter 6. Paranoia. Catherine Manners. Subs didn't have conning towers in World War II, said the woman at the table next to Kate's. Are you crazy? Replied a man sporting massive sunglasses. I just watched a show on the History Channel, Great Ships. It was practically a... Kate adjusted her earplugs to drown out the conversation. The same opinionated crew gathered every morning at Canyon Street Roasters. She didn't like sitting too close. They guffawed every time a watered-down dirty joke was offered, which interrupted her flow. The coffee bar staff didn't hassle her about spending a few hours a day on their Wi-Fi, but it wasn't the quietest of places. Some days, the idea of renting a desk at one of those trendy shared office co-locations seemed like the way to go, today especially. Big sunglasses guy was giving her the creeps. No, she was just off balance. Most of her clients were more comfortable meeting in a crowded cafe, maybe because it provided anonymity or because it made them less conscious that they were seeking the services of a private investigator in the first place. Meeting over coffee just seemed so normal. More than anything, she craved normal after what had happened. Kate rubbed her forehead. Trying to think of something other than two nights ago at BDR wasn't working. Why should it? When the world had shown her, it was a far stranger place than she'd ever suspected. She'd found herself reeling like a drunk a few times, but sans the alcohol. Reality had crumbled before her. She kept seeing that man appearing a layer at a time, his desperate eyes, and finally, the pool he'd become. Her phone chimed with the Los Lobos ringtone she'd selected for Raul. She snatched it, relieved at the interruption. "Hello?" she said into the handset. "Raul, where the fuck are you? I've been here for 20 minutes. "Catherine Janeway Manners?" came Raul's voice, his slight Mexican accent softening the consonants. She sighed and said, "I knew telling you my middle name was a mistake." Her parents had been fans of the Federation. "What's the passphrase?" came Raul's voice again, now tinged with a trace of anxiety. Raul was a security researcher who sometimes did odd jobs on the side when he wasn't collecting bug bounties on enterprise-level software packages. Odd jobs such as working with her. Kate suppressed a second sigh, instead reciting into the phone, "Tiny purple fishes." "Ah, thank you, Kate. You can never be too sure." "He always said that." "Yeah, right. I'm glad I can help out with your issues. I hate to think what your monthly psychiatrist bill must be. Where are you?" A few seconds ticked by, then someone tapped her shoulder. She didn't spill her coffee, but only because the top was secured. "Raul," she said, keeping her voice level, "I'd worry less about hidden enemies and more about pissing off your friends. Some of them have guns." Raul took the seat across from her, smirking. He set a cup of tea on the table and slid his computer bag to the floor at his feet. "You don't need a gun," he said. He'd said the same before, and as before, she pretended not to hear it. She replied, "Thanks for showing up." "It's Sunday. Don't tell me you didn't expect me." "So what have you got for me, Michula?" He sipped his tea. She wrestled her irritation into submission so her voice wouldn't be tight or rushed. Raul was sensitive to those sorts of things, and she didn't want to spook him. Nor did she want to give him any reason to suspect she was about to lie, if only by omission. For someone good with computers, Raul was surprisingly good at reading people. "I'm on another case, like the one you helped me out with last time." Raul pursed his lips. "Another forged ID?" "No, I've already infiltrated the target. What I need is for you to break the encryption on a flash drive and tell me what's on it."
"I might be able to help," said Raul. "Depends on how they implemented their crypto. See if..."
She stopped him with a hand on his wrist. "Yeah, yeah, I just need you to take a look." Raul knew her background, but he couldn't help lecture her anyway. Probably one of the reasons they never hit it off was because she was afraid she'd eventually take his infuriating habit of explaining everything personally. He furrowed his brow.
"I assume you want the information for a client.
Why not just give him the flash drive?"
She looked at him, wondering how to explain what she'd found.
"Him or her?"
Raul amended. She grinned.
"No,
I mean, yeah, my client is male, but I can't get in touch. Not that Bradley probably has anything to do with the flash drive. He had me looking for exploits on a server, but, I found the flash drive instead.
What's it to you, if your client does not want it?
Something weird happened, and the USB might help explain.
Usama said, is everything all right?
Shit, so much for your plan not to spook the paranoid. Plus, she told Raul Bradley's name, not professional. Kate said, I'm upset because there was a third party, and I have his flash drive. That explanation approached the truth. Raul's brows furrowed.
A third party? You mean like a foreign national? Or someone closer to home? CIA? Or NSA, maybe?
Definitely not local. She couldn't imagine anything more foreign than a melting man. He said his name was Jason. I found him in the server room, hurt. He asked for my help. Then he died. It was terrible.
He died?
Raul's eyes widened, and he unconsciously pushed back a few inches from the table. Kate put a hand to her mouth.
Damn it! She hadn't meant to admit that. She was more shaken than she'd realized. Now Raul would pack up and leave.
Except he didn't. Instead, he said,
I'm sorry. It must have been awful. He wasn't going to bolt, at least not immediately.
Maybe she'd underestimated him. He continued. You'd never seen him before? And he had no ID? She said, the only thing he had on him was this custom USB stick.
Where did this go down?
BDR, said Kate. Banks Digital
Realty.
It's a commercial server farm.
Any police involvement?
No, Kate said. But I have no idea what happened after I left. Raul pulled his laptop from its bag and fired it up as if it was the most normal response in the world. She grabbed his hand and squeezed.
Thank you, Raul.
A smile lit his face. He said,
I'm happy to help, Michula. Now then, I haven't heard of BDR, but let's see what the internets have to say. And can I see this mysterious drive?
What? Do you want to check it here?
Where else? I'm not going to pop an unidentified USB stick into a device connected to my home network.
Public Wi-Fi is the only way to go.
If the drive is loaded with malware and tries to phone home when we plug it in, I don't want to be pinged by them.
Like good paranoids everywhere, she reflected. Raul referred to all the various government and corporate organizations he feared were after him as them.
Wait, Raul said, meeting her gaze, with eyes wider than when she told him about the dying stranger. You didn't plug it into your home network, did you?
Raul, what kind of an idiot do you take me for? Why do you think I called you?
Right. Sorry.
His eyes returned to his screen, fingers tapping the keyboard.
Banks Digital Realty,
he read from the screen.
24-hour support, unlimited bandwidth, server hosting, other stuff.
These guys offer everything. Raul settled back in his chair.
I hope whatever's encrypted on that drive is more interesting than this website.
Me too, she handed him the ring. Be careful.
Don't teach a dog to fetch, Kate, he said as he examined the large costume jewel on the ring, and after a little fiddling exposed the USB end as she had.
Custom case, eh?
Yeah, ever seen anything like it?
He shrugged.
No, but some people are into mods. I've seen USB drives that look like dolls, cigarette lighters, car keys, and toys.
I don't think it's a toy.
Yeah, it's too dramatic, said Raul. It looks more like a movie prop.
Kate sucked in her breath.
Could it be? Has she crashed some sort of special effects demonstration? If so, maybe she hadn't actually seen a man melt. Except there'd been no lights, camera, action.
These... Jason, said Raul.
You never saw him before?
She shook her head.
Nor would she see him again. given what happened. She said, "Just tell me what I've got here."
Raoul did something to his keyboard and restarted his laptop. Then he plugged the business end of the ring into a port on the side.
"He's mounting," he noted.
Kate studied Raoul's screen. She didn't recognize